Hey, we want to thank Path Projects for sponsoring this edition of Trail Runner Nation. They're great stuff. I don't leave my house to go running without their gear.
Whenever you wear it, you just feel good. And we talk about it on the podcast today. When you wear something you like, you just perform better.
I don't know why anybody would wear anything other than Path Projects. I love the way my phone fits in the pockets. I love that the way they feel. I don't know if I told you about this, Freeman. Before I started wearing Path Projects, my shorts would kind of climb up in the inseam, and I'd always be I'd always be pulling them down. I don't have that problem with Path Projects. They ride where they're supposed to ride because they're designed for running.
The material stretches in every way a runner moves and stretches, and that's the brilliance behind it. It's not only the stitching, it's not only the cut and the design, but it's the fabric.
Go get yourself some Path Projects gear at pathprojects.com, or you can go to trailrunnernation.com. We have a banner on the partners page that you can click, and it'll link you right on over.
All right, we ready?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Don. You know, I mean, I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, you sound like a nice guy on this podcast, but...
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards, and...
I've never prepped for a podcast, ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
What, are you balancing your checkbook over there, AJW? What's going on?
You're
recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right, are we ready?
Yeah. Hey, thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And we are innovators. At least we like to proclaim that we're innovators. And we have a new show for you, a new show that may end up being a series. We're going to call it Bonk or No Bonk. Is that what we're calling it, Don?
Well, yeah, it's similar to what we do with Audio Magazine, Grab Bag, and all the familiar things. We just put a different label on it, and we package the same product. And so this is like thumbs up, thumbs down. We bring expert coaches on, and we really rely on Ian Sharman and his crew. Today we have a couple of his other coaches here we'll introduce in just a moment to bring up some topics and discuss them around the table. Thumbs up means, hey, I agree with that. Thumbs down means I don't agree with that. And so you might want to get a whiteboard out and put this down, because I have it on the top of my sheet, that actually, thumbs up means not to bonk, right? I mean, you've had a positive experience. And it also means you agree. So I'm literally reading on my whiteboard now. And to bonk means thumbs down or disagree. Just remember, to bonk is bad, unless you're in England. So, Scott, you have any clarifications on that?
Shall I explain the bonking in England thing?
Ian, you may need to do some translation for our European...
Yeah, well, for those who don't know, it does mean something sexual, so it's a good thing.
So you may recognize that voice. That's Ian Sharman, and he is a coach. He provides a blog at I Run Far. He holds a record for the Grand Slam of ultra running. He's a winner of Leadville 100 in 2013, 15, 16, 17, a 10-time finisher at Western States. He's a head coach, and he brings Chrissy Mayo with us here today, one of the coaches here, her first time on this podcast, and she is a champion as well. She's written the book Running Ultra, Running Your First Ultra. She's been a race director for Chuckanut 50K for nearly 17 years. We'll get clarification on that. She's a coach as well. She's won UTMB in 2003 and 2000. Chrissy, is that right? 2003? Yeah, give me the right numbers on that.
3 and 9.
3 and 9. That's exactly what I have written down, Chrissy. And Hard Rock in 2007. And we also have a familiar voice, which is David Roche, the Happy Runner. He's written the book, The Happy Runner. He, in 2014, was a USA Trail Runner of the Year, and he's a 2-time national champion and a 3-time member of Team USA for trail running. Welcome, all of you, to what used to be known as Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, which is morphed into Bonk or Not to Bonk. Scott.
Thank you. So excited.
I'm impressed with all that information, Don.
Oh, well, that was part one of the podcast, and we will go to part two with the actual show. There was so much there. I just kept writing. It's just like, when does this stop? The credentials of these guests are just...
Yeah.
And I trimmed them down, believe me.
An FBI background check on us, it sounds like.
Yeah.
He knows whether we have antibodies for COVID. He didn't say it, but he knew.
Excellent. Well, I would say we would go ladies first on this, but I think that maybe since Christy, this is your first time on the TRN podcast, that maybe we should go with Ian. You want to bring up a topic first, and then we'll parlay into Chrissy's topic. So well, shoot us with the topic there, Ian.
Sounds good. I purposely didn't go for COVID related ones. I know we will have some of that, but my first one is should very easy effort runs make up the majority of training? And that's a universal applying to anyone. So should it or shouldn't it?
I am going to say that it doesn't have to be. I would say I'm going to go with a, I'm going to disagree. So I'm going to go bonk.
Boo. I need to hear the rationale for that. I'm going not bonk and I'm going to be confrontational to try.
Oh, nice.
I want to hear what you have to say on why.
Chrissy, go ahead, and then I'm going to follow up. And to reiterate, Ian, you're saying that easy runs should be part of our training regime. Should be
something. Easy runs should make up the majority of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm saying a no bonk to that. So same as David.
Yes.
I'm agreeing with it.
Chrissy, and then I'll go.
I'll go confrontational on it, too. I'm going to agree with Scott in the bonk.
Ooh,
well, yes. Yes, I knew I liked Chrissy. I knew from the moment I saw her, I liked her.
You know, I'm going to go no bonk just because I find it's to my advantage when I go against Scott. And so I'm going to agree. I'm going to go with Ian and David.
Validate your position, Ian.
Well, yeah, shall I start off with my rationale, which is basically that the body can't withstand really hard training all the time. And you need to be feeling good enough going into those sessions and be able to push yourself with a speed session or a long run. But the vast majority, a high percentage, probably somewhere around about 80% based on a lot of research, shows that you should be doing stuff at an easy effort, which I'm going to describe as being below the ventilatory threshold, basically meaning you could talk basically on it. So it's not really getting you too out of breath. And so for different people, it's different speeds, but it would feel what most of us would think of as easy as long as you're a regular runner. If you're not running regularly, nothing feels easy. And so it takes a while to get to that point. But for the vast majority, it means a effort level where you could at least hold some degree of a conversation.
Hey, David, let's pile on and get all of our position up front, and then we'll let the other two just pick it apart or find any weakness they can and try to wedge us away from our position.
Great. So I'm going to just jump in with like a really small scale point that I think has a broader application to this entire topic of easy runs, which is the idea of angiogenesis, which is capillary growth around muscle. It's essentially how the body transports fuel and waste products. And some really interesting physiological studies look at that and find that harder efforts can actually suppress that process. So that's why, like in classic linear training, how a lot of training philosophy developed, you'll see these big base periods where almost all the running is easy mixed with a little bit of faster stuff and some tempo, followed by then intense stuff at the end. Because if you did the intense stuff the entire cycle, for a lot of athletes, that process would start to go downhill. So the aerobic enzyme action would actually start to reverse. And so even as an athlete is starting to get faster in the peaking phase, they can get aerobically a little bit less efficient. And because aerobic efficiency goes into everything, especially in trail running, and it's something that can develop long term. That's why I think easy running needs to be a primary focus for most athletes. With the caveat, well, I'm not going to give myself caveats on this because I think I'm going to try to be tough this time. So that's my answer.
Hey, David, that's no fair bringing science into this.
It could have just been made up.
Well, good. Then it's my turn to help support this concept without any science at all. Now, this is just from the layman's perspective that when we run very long, we're running pretty easy. We need to practice what we do during races. So going casual and going easy is just where we want to have the majority of our training going. So I'm just going to go with that simple fact, non-scientific. So well done, Ian. Well done, David, for bringing science and journals to our position. And I'm just going to say we typically don't run that fast. So Chrissy or Scott, do you have do you want to change your position?
I'm going to be chivalrous.
Okay.
I'm going to say go Chrissy, and then I'll back it up with.
and we've done this. I love our conversations. I'm so psyched to be on here with you guys. The reality, what my no bonk, or right, no, my bonk, sorry. See, I knew I messed that up. My bonk on this is that my belief in what I see in a lot of runners and my knowing myself is we will all go do easy miles. That's the best part, is like being out for hours and hours, and like that's what we love to do. That's easy. So being able to challenge at least once or twice a week. And so I guess my thing is I do agree with the majority part, but I wanted to throw the bonk in there to say, like, we need to have different gears. We need to switch it up. I love, David, I love working on these like 30-second repeats that you've got on my schedule. Like just those little hits of different speed is, I think it's really cool to stay and important to stay tuned into those. So throwing in different gears, and then just to mix up the mental part of running, because the challenge of, like, if you're just doing this, like if you just do the same loop and you run the same pace and you do that every day and like, talk about our timing and where we are right now, you could have to do that. You might have to stay on the same loop while you stay home and do the right thing, and you only get your little bit of time outside for exercise. So I'd like challenge people to mix it up so that running stays a really important part of it and like a rewarding part of the day. And so I'm not saying every day, I definitely am of the majority, like we need that aerobic base. But I just wanted to throw the bonk in there. I see a lot of like, everybody wants to comment on this.
Well, first I'll jump in really quick to just say, I'm not supposed to say I agree. So I'm going to be careful.
But no, that's okay.
What I wanted to ask Chrissy was, you know, when you're looking at an athlete and you are introducing some of this stuff, so I assume there's people listening to this that are like, well, I don't do anything structured right now, you know, or whatever. Is there a way that you introduce them into that process that you find is most helpful?
Yeah, little bits at a time, and finding a point during the week where it makes sense for them.
What might be an example workout for, I mean, I know you can't, million caveats, but like for an athlete that is thinking, okay, I just go out and run every day. How do I, like, what would the first, like a first workout be for them, or like, you know, early on?
Well, I guess the reality is there, I would have a couple of weeks of like base mileage, like not throwing a lot of workouts at them, seeing how their body responds to a more consistent approach. A lot of people are looking for that consistency right now. So getting a base mileage before throwing workouts at them. But what I was just speaking to, I will throw those 30-second repeats with like lots of recovery in between each one, and really explain that it's not about sprinting, because I think people have a visual of what sprinting is. It's about your most efficient, like best form you can imagine. And a lot of times when you're doing that, your legs will turn over faster. Like think of it that way, not like trying to gut out the fastest pace you can. It's more about how your body is moving at that, for those 30 seconds, just this really good focus on those, how the body's moving in those 30 seconds. So I'll start that way and then move into other workouts.
I love that. And it's so good to emphasize to people listening that it doesn't have to be these big things that you might read about in a running magazine or like an article I write or something. It can be something that's much less like psychologically demanding, but also really fun. So I love that, Chrissy. Thanks.
Hey, Scott, I'm going to jump in front of your comment because I know you're next to try to shore your opinion up. Did we just learn, Chrissy, that David is your coach?
You did.
Wow. I had no idea. You've made a great choice. I'm not surprised at that. It's nice to know this.
Oh yeah, I'm the luckiest man ever. But we disagree.
I know.
How is this? I need to get people in line.
Or she needs a new coach. One of the two.
Yeah, exactly.
Scott.
Hey, I think you guys all agree. From what Chrissy said, I said most of it's easy, not all of it's easy. And that's what Chrissy was saying. Yeah, I totally agree. We need hard sessions in there. They are absolutely essential. And also the thing that I think Chrissy pointed out really well there is that we need to have variety in the easy runs. It's not just do the same loop at the same pace every day. Run different places, run different times a day, definitely want to have lots of different gears, just that the majority of it is on the easier side of things, as and that allows you to then do this hard sessions a bit harder.
Mm-hmm. I think that, but you're speaking in a time where some people are like restricted to their treadmill. And so how do you keep that? Or I've heard of balcony marathons or like these, like what people are doing right now, like how do you keep it interesting? I've definitely seen my own creativity like ramp up, like send me a picture when you're out there. I want to see what you saw today. Or I've got somebody making a creative, she's got to do the same loop. And so I was like, track it. Track how many loops you do during quarantine. So she's going to make like a fun artsy thing that she can like, I think she's going to draw a tree on it every day or for every loop that she ends up doing. If she does three in one day, she'll draw three trees. I love that kind of stuff.
And related to that, given that some countries have been much more restricted than the US, I've had people in Spain and South Africa who they basically weren't able to go outside at all and they didn't have treadmills. So they were doing up and down the stairs. They were wearing weight vests around the house. They were going up and down like a 50-foot driveway multiple times. But we tried to just avoid doing too much of that and said, look, this is a short-term thing. You'll be running again soon. And for example, South Africa had about 4 weeks and now they're allowed to run outside again with restrictions. Mm-hmm. But instead I said to them, okay, well, let's give a different target to keep it varied and to stop yourself going insane. So for the final week of that quarantine, I just said, let's aim for 10,000 steps around the house every day rather than a distance to run. And it just keeps things fresher. So this is more about the mental side than just the physical side.
We haven't heard from Scott yet. I want to Scott, come on.
I'm gonna be a little bit off kilter here. I'm gonna throw some science in it because David threw science in, and it's actually was one of my topics. So it's kind of a lead in to my topic, but it actually refers to this one quite a bit. And this is some scientists at McMaster University did a study where they took some sedentary folks. So keep that in mind. Took a group of sedentary people and they put them on a 12-week exercise regime. Actually, there were three groups. One was stay sedentary, no exercise. The second one was to do moderately intense exercise, 45 minutes a day for 12 weeks. And the third group was doing sprint interval training for the same 12 weeks. The sprint interval training ended up being, let me see if I can get it here. It is 3 20-second sprint intervals. So they did a warm-up of 2 minutes, 20 seconds of sprint, 2 minutes of warm or jogging, another 20 seconds, another 2 minutes of recovery, 20 seconds of interval, and then a 3-minute cool down. So it took them a fifth of the time that it took the 45-minute person. And then they measured them according to cardiorespiratory fitness and insulin sensitivity, and they found there was no difference. That the person that did the 1 minute of sprinting, chopped up into three segments with some rest periods in between, actually had the same cardiorespiratory fitness response and insulin sensitivity response as a person that went out and put 45 minutes of moderate training in on the trail, maybe not on, maybe on the treadmill.
I'd say a couple of things related to that. One of them is that a better control group, rather than saying sedentary is the starting point for all of them, is active, being active in the first place. That is the natural state of humans throughout history. It's only now that sedentary is more normal, but it's not what the body has been developed and evolved to do. So that's one thing I would say that's an issue with a lot of these studies that start with people at such low levels of fitness. But it also brings up the fact that there's a lot of different ways to get fit. No doubt about that. There's not just like one perfect training plan, but certainly starting from a near zero base, there's going to be more risks there about doing the higher intensity stuff, especially immediately. So the couple of things that would be an issue with that being more widely applicable would be firstly that most of the people who listen to this are already runners, so they're not starting from zero. Secondly, that they are more likely to get injured if they just do lots of hard stuff all the time. And thirdly, they're more likely to burn out. There have been other studies where they had big gains, where they had a group of, I think it was cyclists to make it more sustainable, but they were doing basically hard workouts every day or every other day, and in between it was a time trial or something like that. And they kept getting fitter, but at the end of several weeks, they all quit. They just said, we're not going to do it anymore. It was just totally unsustainable because it was too hard for them. And that was before the point where they got injured that may have forced them to stop anyway. So that's the couple of things that I'd throw into that mix there. The fact that sedentary is not the norm, and that there's a higher chance of injury of trying to do too much all the time.
You know, I didn't make it to the end of the article, but I don't think that they track that injury level. You know, if you're taking a sedentary person and saying, okay, do a 2-minute warm up and then sprint fast for 20 seconds, there's got to be some injuries that are involved in that. I gotta think.
Yeah, and
David, go ahead.
That type of study is actually incredibly instructive, and I think it proves our point. So yeah, I'm coming in with it. So essentially what you're measuring there is the time horizon of adaptations. So essentially anaerobic processes, VO2 max, things like that, all adapt relatively rapidly in a person's trajectory, whether someone's sedentary or not. So as soon as you light that fuse, the bomb's getting ready to go off. And you get to, the fuse is only so long. VO2 max will only improve by 15% in anyone from some baseline. Or, you know, so even if you're talking about more involved trials that are doing different types of workouts, you see the same thing. So I'm gonna come back with a different study that I think is probably the most instructive, I think, for people thinking about how to do workouts, getting back to what Chrissy said of sustainable workouts, things like that. So this study took relatively trained people and had one group do very hard workouts. Essentially, all of their intense efforts that they're talking about are going to the well, you know, those really deep ones, whether if you like you're racing your hill intervals, that sort of thing. One group did much more sustainable workouts, so at a very controlled percentage of VO2 max. And the really interesting thing is that after 12 weeks, they were in the same spot, but how they got there is what matters. The first group, the high intensity group, had 60% of their gains in the first 10% of the trial. And then it leveled off, and by the end, it just fully leveled. The group that was doing more sustainable, mostly easy with some controlled, playful workouts, as Chrissy mentioned, was progressing in a much more linear fashion. And so if you charted that out over years, you're starting to see, oh, well, the person that goes really hard at first is really good right away. And that creates a negative, that creates an association cycle that can be really negative for people, because what they want to do is be like, well, why isn't this working for me now? And the point is, it's working the same way it did before. You've just tapped out those adaptations. So instead, if you work on base over and over and over again, you can start improving running economy over years and years and years, even as something like VO2 max levels off. So I think those types of studies are great because it shows, okay, that's how you peak. But what it doesn't show is, well, how does a person actually develop in a time horizon longer than 6 weeks or 12 weeks?
And just to add one thing to that, a really good example is Paula Radcliffe, where, as you were saying, how the VO2 max, we think of that as being one of the big determinants, but there's other factors such as running economy that come into making you faster. So she actually had a higher VO2 max when she was a junior athlete. And then just through more years of consistent training, her VO2 max actually went down, even though she's trained harder. But because of those years of running, her running economy went up by a greater amount that allowed her to be faster. So I definitely say that one of the key ways that lots of easy running helps is just, it allows you to run for more months and more years and get those long-term adaptations.
Yeah.
And like, you know, you can look at someone like Ian and Chrissy as great examples of this in practice. Like, both of them are absolute aerobic behemoths. You know, they are, because they've done this over many years, at any point in their training cycle, like based on just following their careers, they can turn it on and become world beaters very quickly. Because they've used these years, these cumulative aerobic adaptations to really develop. So like, I love following Ian because like, I don't remember which year it was, but one of the years he won Leadville, like, you know, I'm not sure exactly which race it was, but he turned on the training, like relatively close to the race, like to the max level that he does, and then proceeded to have one of the most crazy good races you've ever seen. And like, that's because, you know, he's been spending years doing the relaxed stuff. And then when he needs to go to the well, he's able to do that quickly. And sorry to characterize. Yeah.
Well, in fairness as well, I can't train as hard as some other people. I'm not a 150 mile a week person. So everyone, the more training you're doing, the more years of it, the better you can dial in your own personal sustainable level. Some people know once they hit 70, 80 miles a week, or if it's a newer runner, much lower levels than that, they start getting injured or start getting tired. So a big part of this as well is getting to know your own body better through the training. And again, most of that needs to be easy to allow yourself to know how it feels on those different gears that you're running, as well as different races. But I totally agree with Chrissy being another great example of, if you've been doing this for years, then you can, in a relatively short amount of time, ramp up. Maybe that would be harder actually for the shorter distance stuff. Like if we were all 5K runners, I think that would be a harder thing to do. But for ultra running, so much of that is ingrained long-term adaptations.
Okay, if you're keeping track at home, I think David, Ian, and I actually won that round. I may be a bit biased, but I'm not sure. But I've got this next one that I think is a bit more on the level playing field. So if you didn't subscribe to a scientific journal last month, that's okay, because that's my topic I've brought. And just to kind of tip you off, we're going to be thinking about true or false. Is this a true or false statement? And we're going to be talking about how long do running shoes last when you don't run in them. All right. So we know that runners replace their shoes generally between 300 and 500 miles. Let's just assume that's true for all of us. Okay. We're going to assume that fact. And that's 480 to 800 kilometers if you're outside the United States here or England. And if a person wears their running shoes every day, but they just walk around in them, they will last 800 miles. They'll last much longer. True or false? Throw that around. I have the right answer.
Say it again. I'm not sure I understood what the last part of that was.
Okay, good. If you just use running shoes to walk around in, they'll last 800 miles. If you run in them, they'll last 300 to 500 miles. They wear out faster running, and they'll last longer walking. What do you think?
Chrissy, what do you think?
Well, did you guys know I started in this whole world selling running shoes?
No.
Well, that's why I've picked you on my team for this round, Chrissy. Yes.
Oh, yeah. It's been a few moons since I sold running shoes, and I'm sure the technologies have changed quite a bit in the last two decades. But where I'm going to go with it, where my brain went with it, is the force of impact. So there's everybody has their ratio up, but the basic one is like 3 times your body weight is what's coming down on the running shoes. I've definitely, because of my early schooling, my running shoes are for running only. I don't walk around in them. So in the hopes of keeping the miles, and if it's all up here, I say this on a lot of questions, but if it's all because of what I'm thinking between my ears, not really what's happening to the foam, that plays out for me in terms of what I'm going to do stuff. So that's what I would, in what you're saying, I don't know if I'm true or falsing on it. I just feel like there is more impact when you're running versus walking. So if you get more miles out of them, I oftentimes turn my running shoes into walking shoes. So they end up having a longer life after they're not my running shoes anymore. So I don't know if I'm being a very good teammate, Don.
I'll let you know at the end of this whether you're on my team or not, Chrissy. Anybody else want to go?
Yeah, I'll go for no bonk. I agree that I don't know if it's doubling, but I would completely agree with that, because not just the foam lasting longer. Also, I would guess just the soles won't get ripped apart and the uppers won't get ripped apart as much. If I'm running on a trail, it destroys the shoes relative to if I'm just walking around on the sidewalk.
Either David or Scott.
I'm going to go bonk. I'm going to say not agree, because maybe the amount of time you're spending will actually be greater, along with number of steps. And yes, I'm going to be confident in that answer, because this is my new, I'm confident.
I like your confidence. In fact, you almost had me. I almost made a full switch over to your side, David.
It's animal magnetism. What can I say?
But I'm gonna go along with Ian as a no bonk, and saying that you can get more miles walking than running.
So here's my source: 50 interesting facts runners should know. Okay, so very scientific. found it on the internet. I'm going to read it verbatim.
Which means it's true.
Runners replace their running shoes every 300 to 500 miles. If a person wears their running shoes for everyday use, the shoes will last only around 200 miles. Whoa. David.
I was extremely confident, citing my years of experience.
You wear your running shoes for running to get the running miles out of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to reduce my running miles out of there, even if it's just between my ears that I'm thinking that.
So we're basically saying there's a certain number of footsteps before they get wrecked, and if you're walking, you just cover less distance.
You know what would have helped me if I read the entire article instead of a small sentence, because maybe the criteria was how much padding is left or how much, you know, how much efficiency you can get out of a shoe. When did they decide it was retired? You know, it may not be just because the bank account said it was time to get one, or your spouse said those shoes have holes in them. I don't know their criteria, but for the amount of investigation I did for my article, which was search 50 interesting facts and pulling it out and hoping it played out better than this.
You know, the tricky thing there is because you had a precise number saying 800 miles, that makes us think it must be a real thing and that you just didn't pull that out of your...
Oh, I did throw that in. I did throw that in to make it a bit interesting, sound scientific.
Chrissy?
But are we talking a pair of Hokas or are we talking a pair of Vibram Five Fingers? Like, what is our go-to here? Like, there's a lot of different foam levels in those two models.
Well, my default on that is, what are you wearing, Chrissy?
I wear a variety of stuff. On trails, I wear the Vasque Trail Bender, which is no longer on the market. I just have a garage full of them. And on roads, I switch it up. So I'm always an 8mm drop. I'm not in the zero or low drop. I'm very old school on shoes that have worked for me for a long time.
That's another good topic. Who's next?
I think Chrissy.
Your relationship with daily runs is more important than a race.
Ooh.
Agree or disagree?
I'm going to lead with that one and just say absolutely agree. Thumbs up, no bonk. Your daily relationship with your training is more important than a race. Yes.
No bonk.
Yeah, no bonk here as well. Especially right now is a good time to test this theory.
Come on, David. Come on, David. Be confident. Be confident.
Yeah, stand up against your peers.
This is like everything I stand for. I can't go against. No, I'll say no bonk. I just think a race is another one of your daily runs. So, like, you know, finding a process by which you can like love yourself in that framework is all that matters. And no race result, whether it's winning a world championship or you know, DNFing or DNSing, will change that that cycle that started long before.
This is something I've been speaking to a lot of the people I coach about recently, which is just, okay, so maybe races aren't happening for quite a while. So what is it you liked about the races? What is it that was appealing? Was it the fact that it was a beautiful location or the travel or the community? And what can you still get without there being races? So is it a virtual race? So you have some kind of community? Is it that you go and do trails, whatever's allowed anyway, nearby your house or something that's drivable rather than in another country? But it's just looking at what it is you like about racing and then making sure that that's part of your general training and what you're going to be doing in the coming months. And this is a perfect time to not just do things by default because that's the race you always do in that month, and instead think about it a bit more.
Chrissy?
And that's where I was going with this line of thinking is, like, if there's never another race on the calendar, just what is, I feel like that's what's come out of a lot of my coaching right now, is this silver lining of like this gift of running that we have on a daily basis. And I'm so thankful to have this lesson reinforced. It sucks that it has to be done this way, but I feel like it's something that really can come out of this time, is like, why do you really love running? Is it so that you can, I think where you're headed with that, Ian, like for me, I think community, people gathering together, we all love to do it. We're like-minded individuals. We all get to come together. And that's outside of my running. So really helping people have their own relationship to running. So that daily, that daily connection to it, whatever it is. Anyway, yeah, Scott, you got something.
I was just going to say, we all know runners, and I'm thinking of one person specifically that Don and I know. I'm not going to say his name, but he's racing almost every weekend, at least twice a month. And I haven't talked to him or seen him out on the trails since we've gone to this shut-in type lifestyle. But I'm wondering if I know he loves racing so much that he does it that much. I wonder how he's doing. I wonder if he has been able to, like you said, Chrissy, find really what is it about running that he really enjoys? Or like Ian, like you said, can he duplicate some of those attributes in just going out and training? What have you guys found? Have you found that there's people you're coaching that just have exploded because they can't race?
I have a couple of people who are struggling a lot more. I was actually just speaking to someone this morning because Leadville 100 Miler is 4 months away, and the earlier races they have in June, this morning an email went out saying, hey, all the June stuff and the training camp is canceled. So this person is now thinking, well, that means the 100 Mile is canceled, so why should I even train? What's the point of it all? I love that race. I really want to do it. That's why I'm training. Everything's about doing that. And so we're trying to work out, well, what else will allow you to do that? Firstly, to maybe doing that race the year after, for one thing, but also, what is it about the race that really appeals? And in that case, it was to do with the history and the difficulty of it and not being able to finish it in the past. So I said, oh, well, what about having potentially a vacation there and running on the course and going up the mountains nearby? And maybe also having that training go towards something else epic and beautiful, like doing the Grand Canyon rim to rim to rim when a little bit more travel is possible. So we were just trying to pick apart where the motivations were. That was the key thing. It was, okay, so you're telling me that what I've just suggested doesn't sound good enough. So what does? What is interesting about running for you personally that will make you want to get out the door? And that's a difficult conversation, but this is the ideal time, if you should always have an idea about this, but especially now, to just be able to really work out what you like about running and then focus on that a little bit more.
David, what do you think? What do you see out there with your clients?
Yeah, and I've seen just such a wide array of responses that are totally unpredictable. And I think that gets back to something about this whole situation more broadly, which is it's not a choice. You know, this external circumstance that none of us hopefully were anticipating is interacting with our brain chemistry and our backgrounds in such a unique and weird way that being good at a pandemic is not something we need to strive toward. Hopefully it's not something that is like a common occurrence in our future. So if you're one of the people listening that has fallen off or whatever, I would just say that's okay. Like there are pro athletes I coach who have lost a lot of their motivation. And then there are just like people that never seemed to like running before who are now more motivated than ever. And my guess is that doesn't have to do necessarily as much with their relationship with running as like, you know, something that happened when they were teenagers or, you know, like, I mean, it's much more deep than that. And so what I would say, if you are struggling, is like anywhere that you feel resistance, especially if it's like an existential crisis related to your running or something, is a place where you'll find answers. Like, that's the interesting stuff. So if you're feeling that, you actually have an opportunity to sit down in it and start to like, okay, why am I feeling this way? And how does this like actually, can I grow from that? So I would just say, if you're struggling, no, it's totally okay. But there's probably an opportunity there to reshape your relationship, like with what you're doing, in a way that makes it like more sustainable and fun long term.
Mm-hmm. And just because it's struggling right now doesn't mean it will be next week. Maybe you're just having a bad day or a bad week, and it's just keep going through that and know that things will change anyway, and that everyone's having those bad days, and that's not a reflection on you as a being weak or not being able to cope with things.
I'm curious, if you don't mind answering the question, where are you three with your relationship and with running during this time? Is it better? Is it worse? Where is it? Chrissy, how about you?
I go back. Running has been the most consistent thing in my life for 2 decades. Like, it has seen me through so many different highs and lows of life, moving, relationships, divorce, like, those are a lot of lows and highs. And I just feel like, and David asked me this really early on, like, how are you doing? I'm like, I am thankful. Like, running is the thing that, whether I'm running daily, I might not be running. I'm really not running any more miles. In fact, probably less miles, but I have that daily relationship with this thing that's constant for me. And David, you made the statement of like, you can sit down with these feelings. For me, I go for a run with these feelings. Like that's that same meditative spot that running provides that for me. And I know not everybody has running in their life that way. Whatever that is, maybe it's sitting and meditating, maybe it's cooking, maybe it's, having a conversation with somebody, writing in your journal, going for a walk, whatever the person's place is to get to that, where they get to sink into themselves. And so not much has changed actually with my running. It's there for me, whatever I'm doing. So I'm thankful.
How about you, Ian?
Yeah.
Go ahead, David.
Oh, sorry about that. I was just going to jump in at Chrissy and just say that like the amount that I she mentioned what I asked her, and I feel like I'm like, are things okay? Like almost like one of those scared parents for no reason. And she's just like, things are great. Like she's like at that peaceful place, which I've been so inspired by myself personally. And like, yeah, for me, I mean, I always love the day-to-day grind more, I would say more than anything. So it's a nice excuse for me to, just be outside each day and go through the ups and downs. So yeah, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm actually really enjoying my running this year. Obviously, a lot of the things are kind of sucking, but I got injured last year. I had an Achilles injury through the second half of the year that was really annoying. Then I start getting into great fitness and then all the races get canceled. And it's not that dissimilar to a lot of other people who are ready for spring races and they were super excited and maybe were peaking and stuff like that. But then as soon as I had that initial week of kind of getting over it and realizing this was what was going to happen, I decided, okay, well, there's other races later in the year, so that's one thing. But also I started questioning, what is it that I want to be able to do? And I think it's the added difficulty for all three of us as coaches and as people who are making a living from this and as professional runners. If you can't race, it's harder to justify sponsors. So that was a little bit more of a concern for me. But this is going to be the year that a lot of professional runners do FKTs, the fastest known time events, that kind of thing. And I just decided this was a chance to work on some stuff that I wouldn't normally have time for. So I've been doing 1 mile and 5K time trials. I'm quicker than I've ever been at any stage in my life. And I turned 40 in a few months' time. But my Achilles isn't 100%, but it's allowing me to hammer it. So I'm not worried about that. But I'm actually really enjoying just doing time trials. It's not even a race. It's not even an official PR because of that. But it's still really motivating me and getting me excited. Plus, it's making me think of fun stuff to do in the summer. So there's certain mountains in the Pacific Northwest. I live in Oregon. There's ones that I can drive to that I haven't had a chance to explore as much. So now I'm going to have time. One of the things that's been on my to-do list for years, but it's kind of awkward to squeeze in, is running around Mount Rainier. It's a 93-mile run called Wonderland Trail. I'm going to do it over 3 days just as a nice training thing. And I couldn't necessarily squeeze that in otherwise. So now I'm thinking there's all these cool adventures, and it's just opening my eyes to being a bit more creative. Instead of someone else coming up with an idea and it's a race and I just go and do it, I'm getting a chance to think of those things for myself. And that is super motivating. I am genuinely probably feeling better about my running than I have done for years, despite not being able to do races and despite still having a lingering injury. But I'm actually loving that side of my life. And I think this is what I'm trying to bring to the other people I'm coaching, is saying, if you can find these same kind of motivators for yourself, you may find this is an incredibly positive year from a running perspective, where you can also maybe work on weaknesses and come out the other side nailing races. You also may not care as much about races at that point.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think what we're seeing here is actually something I see a lot too, which is, so I coach a lot of coaches, and in that context, like almost all of them are echoing a lot of these same ideas with their own pursuits, not just the, and I think like it helps sometimes for people that don't have that perspective. I mean, every coach is like zoomed out and seeing a lot of people go through these struggles, and it gives a certain amount of perspective that you're not alone in your low days, you know, or in your motivation struggles or anything else that is freeing in some ways. So like, if you don't have that, like, try to talk to people about it still, because I think that once you start doing that, you see the same things we're talking about, which is, yeah, there's going to be low moments, and you know, yeah, you might be a little sad that you can't do something in particular, but you know, we're all in this together, and you're feeling the way you're feeling is normal, and we can keep building. So like, the usual thing of when you're down, you know, go get lifted up by like through in like, you know, fully engaging with someone as much as you can, even if that's like, you know, on social media, honestly, like it can be positive, like almost anywhere.
But probably not Twitter.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Hey, my question to three of you coaches and elite runners, without a race on the calendar, without, you know, your sponsors and people that follow you, we'll call them fans, and that are watching and have high expectations and maybe even higher than your own expectations in some cases, does it feel good just to get out there and run watch free, expectation free, and just enjoy the journey down the trail without any concern of where's my heart rate, what's my time per mile, how am I gonna hit the peak right for that race? Is it nice just to get out there and run?
Honestly, Don, that's been my whole running career. There's only been one race, the Western States 2009, that I tried to do what you're talking about. And I ended up in the medical tent for 6 hours. I passed out. I had 2 bags of IV fluid. And I said, I'm never racing like this again. That was dumb.
Wow.
So I honestly, I feel like that's been my running. And I had great successes over the 2 decades. And I learned maybe the hard way with that one, that in that one, I was about 9 years into the ultra running world at that point. Why did I switch something that was working just great? Kind of like the same thing with shoes. I'm not going to zero drop. 8 to 12 millimeter works great for me. My happy approach to running has worked great for, why would I switch it? So I don't know. The quarantine hasn't changed that for me, because that's been my MO.
Nice, nice. Ian, I saw you just shaking your head. Almost, your headphones almost came off. You were in agreement.
I was in complete agreement of that. I learned quite a long time ago, soon after I first started getting sponsored, but 9 or 10 years ago, that you don't just do things for the sponsor, or you don't just do things for likes on social media, although you can't help but think about that aspect of it, undoubtedly, if you're making a living from it, and everyone does, even if you're not making a living from it. But I definitely found that just winning a big race doesn't suddenly magically make everything good. And so if you expect it to, you're going to keep getting disappointed. There was, I don't know who it was, but there was a coach of an Olympian who was saying, if your world and everything about your life isn't enough without that gold medal, it's not suddenly going to magically become perfect with the gold medal. Mm. So you've got to be happy with how things are, with just the process of it, not just the outcome, because it's not a magical switch that just changes things. So I realized that for myself a long time ago, and it honestly doesn't feel any different. I'm setting new targets for myself that no one really cares about. Like me running my fastest mile, it's nowhere near like a professional mile runner, but it's very meaningful to me. And yeah, it's on social media and other people see it, but whatever judgments come out of that, good or bad, I find it, that's not really what it's about. And sometimes you have to consciously remind yourself that, but again, this is a time to be reminded of it and for it to be very clear.
Mm, that's refreshing.
Yeah. And what I would emphasize for anyone listening is that long-term growth is operating, it's past the distant horizon, right? So it's years and years down the line, like what you're capable of and what your potential is. So, you know, this time is stressful and you might not have the psychological and like stress context to do it. But if you do, it's as good of a time as any to go for it. That doesn't mean like looking at your watch. It just means putting yourself out there and like, you know, seeing what you're capable of. The way that biomechanical aerobic and running economy adaptations work, that's all happening over years, not training cycles. So the races are awesome because the races do structure that process and give us that meaning and purpose. But if you can find the purpose in a, like Ian is saying and Chrissy is saying, then you're just starting to scratch the surface of the potential now. You're moving towards that horizon. You're trying to see where your limits actually lie. And, you know, that's always what I find most exciting, is not where the limits lie exactly, like it's the process of actually chasing them, because I think that that's the scary part. And so now's a great time to do scary things.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Well, David, looks like we're only going to have time to do one topic a piece. And David, you're the last one. What topic do you have for us?
Oh my gosh.
Pressure. Well, it's got to be a good one.
I'll go Hill Rubians. So that you're No, I'll go running economy. So running economy matters. Running economy is one of the most important variables for long-term growth, and running economy being the amount of energy it takes to go a given pace. And this is semi, like, I've heard about it, talked about it recently. So I'll throw that out there, and it's okay to talk about other things too.
So what's the bonk, no bonk question though?
Yeah, I was looking for that too. I want running economy. I'm all for running economy. I'm pro running economy.
Well, I mean, it's more, this is a terrible question. We're going to bail. Does anyone else have a question? Scott, do you have a question? Let's go to you.
No, I want to talk about running economy because I think right now, at least for me, I'm a little bit more disciplined in my running, and because of that, I'm able to give myself a task on given runs. Today, I'm gonna work on my running economy. So I want to talk about running economy. And so I'm a pro no economy guy. I say no bonk. Great.
I love
no
it. Bonk. Well, no, I'm basically saying that it's one of the most important things you can focus on in your training. It's not a statement everyone agrees with, so it might just be too far down into the weeds. Well, I'm sure Ian has.
How about
I completely agree. So I'm saying, oh, go on.
I was going to say, how about we structure it this way? You guys are all coaches. What do you tell, or how do you coach your athletes that need to work on running economy? What do you tell them to do? What are there exercises? Are there drills? How do you teach good running economy as a coach?
Well, I'll firstly agree with David. So yes, I'm a no bonk on this, that it is, I would agree, especially for the long term, one of the biggest things to try and improve, and it'll make the biggest difference. And that example I used earlier with Paula Radcliffe, she moved from being a junior athlete to having a lower VO2 max, but being a faster world record holder by improving her running economy. And in terms of working on it, really, I think it's a simple formula of consistency, having speed sessions in there, and amount of time, and those things should be improving. And certainly you'd want to tweak within that, but that would be the rough pattern and the rough concept that I would describe it as being how you'd achieve it and why it's important.
Christy, how about you?
I would just make it real short. I 100% echo what Ian said. The only thing I would add to it is awareness. So body awareness while you're in doing all of those things and improving your economy because you understand your body that much better.
That's awesome. And both of those, essentially, I think for anyone listening, a good way to think of training in general is on one end, you have like improving running economy, which is making it feel easier. So like the whole idea is to get to the point where running can reach a place where you are effortless, or at least like it's you're using less energy for it, or a place of like, the goal is to get better at, you know, dealing with fatigue and pushing. And I always try to steer athletes towards the running economy end, which in practice in their training means I want us to get to feel good. Like I want this process to feel really good. I want us to focus on intervals that you don't kill yourself on until that's the goal. I want us to get good at, you know, just cruising and the relaxed stuff. Christy is a huge proponent of strength work, for example. And like that, those supportive things make a really big difference, and de-emphasize, let's say, like huge miles for their own sake. Like weekly miles isn't the best proxy for growth, nor is like the hardest workouts or biggest volume workouts. So, I think one of the hardest things for athletes, and the reason I brought that up, is there's a temptation to think, oh, well, if I'm not training as this hard, I'm not training as good as I can. And I always want to say that the best hard training outside of like very specific times when you're going all in for something should actually feel not as straining as like you might imagine. So just like a soft entry point to get people that might be a little scared of doing that, taking that step, to just like take that step with the idea that it might actually be uplifting and make things feel better, not make you feel more tired.
You know, as all of you are talking, I refer back to a mantra that I learned from Caballo Blanco in Born to Run. And he said, easy, light, smooth, then fast. So that's actually a mantra that I sometimes think about when I'm running alone, trying to work on running efficiency. I say, am I running easy? Am I light on my feet? Am I smooth? And then the fast will take care of itself. And unfortunately, fast passed me a few, many years ago, but I can still be easy, light, and smooth. Don, did you have something?
Yeah, I wanted to add that, number one, David, great topic. I'm glad you didn't bail on it. Well done.
Confidence.
And I think, yeah. And I think that we should certainly have cues that we check into so we can make sure we're running efficiently with economy and we can learn those. But I think it's important, too, not to decide whether we have economy or not. We need someone, either a camera to view us. We need a good coach to watch us. We need stride analysis over at Charmin Ultra and their evaluations, because we can fool ourselves thinking that we have perfect economy and we're running just right until we go by a big glass mirror and a window and we look and we go, oh, not quite what I was seeing in my own mind is what I'm seeing in that reflection. So I think it's good to reach out and ask your running partner, ask a coach or something to help guide you, because it's pretty tough. You know, you think, oh, I don't heel strike, and then all of a sudden you get a picture and your toes pointing towards the clouds, you know. So it's good to have a third party evaluator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Clients have their kids film them or something, and then like talk through. And honestly, when people watch their own video, or like you said, catch themselves in the mirror, that's like such a huge teacher. Like that third person can help, but like you will teach yourself a lot just by seeing your own form.
Yeah.
Hey, Chrissy,
I will purposely change directions so I don't have to run with my shadow.
Hey, Chrissy.
Like, if my shadow is right there, I'm like, you know, we're going to have to wait and not be partners on this front.
Hey, Chrissy, if you don't mind, I have a question for you about running economy and your 8 millimeter to 12 millimeter drop. I bet you there's a lot of people that are listening thinking, well, now, wait a minute. She's really fast. She must be really efficient runner. And yet she's running in these 8 and 12 millimeter drop shoes. How does that work? Is it, do you worry as much about concentrating on landing on the forefoot? And can you do that in a high drop shoe?
I'm a huge heel striker that has worked towards midfoot. I don't think I'll ever be a forefoot unless I'm like trying to, like I said before, which you're not supposed to do, like really trying to sprint, I'll get up on my toes. I think it's like a volume thing and just practiced. I ran in high school, I had coaches evaluate my form. I have all those things that come through my head, like arm swing. And it's not just what your legs are doing underneath you, how your whole body is lining up, holding your core while you're in form. I don't know if I'm answering your question, and it's not just the shoes. Like it's really hard to find 12 millimeter drop shoes anymore. Like I'm kind of exaggerating on that, but, I'm just stuck. What's not broken, right? Like what works for me?
I think you answered it perfectly, because a lot of times people think if I buy those zero drop shoes, I'm going to be an efficient runner. And that's a small, small portion of it. So thank you. I think that did. Ian?
The thing I want to add there is it's not so much about whether you're forefoot, midfoot, or heel striking. It's about having your foot land beneath your body. And they found even with elite athletes, there is more variation there. And so if the thing that's more of an issue, and again, I'm an ultra runner, so I use zero drop for everything. And I'm very used to that, and it feels very comfortable for me. But it's more about how your foot lands. And so you might be able to get away with bad form a bit more with a massive heel, or even just with very cushioned shoes, because you can have your foot way ahead of you in a straight line and you're not using your knee as a spring. So I'd say with that, it's not necessarily exactly where your foot, which part of your foot lands, but it's where your foot lands beneath your body that's more important to do with efficiency and lowering the chance of injury.
Yeah, and doing that, that's the work I've done, because you see my eighth grade track pictures, I'm like toe to the sky, like you said. But it's just as you get your feet underneath you, not reaching so much, you naturally, you're not on your heel as much. But at least that's what my change has been.
Hey, Scott, before you wrap this up, I want to do one that takes about less than a minute. Okay, and I just want to hear if you guys think that I should have have disqualified my list from reading this because this is one of the very top ones. And as I read this, I should have said, oh, this is fake news, not something I should bring to the podcast. So here's the one of their quotes. Runners who wear red are more likely to win a race. Okay, that answered my question, Chrissy. I should not have used the list.
That's the car that gets pulled over first, you know, on the cop right, or something. Right. Oh.
Do you think it matters what you wear?
I think
maybe they're more aggressive and more confident if they wear red. Who knows?
I think of the bullfighter, right? He's got a red piece of cloth he's waving.
I was going to say they probably
bulls are colorblind. Bulls are colorblind. It doesn't matter what color it is. They're going after the movement. I don't know if you knew that.
Well, Scott, you and I are not qualified to answer this question because we're the only two of the group that haven't won a race. These folks have run multiple.
I was going to say maybe that's the reason I haven't won. I don't have a red shirt.
I'll buy you a red shirt if you buy me a red shirt. Maybe one of these guys can send an old red shirt. They must have plenty. They've won a lot of races.
Not red.
All right, Scott, wrap this thing up.
Hey, I thought we had a great discussion. Obviously we did because we only got through one topic a piece. This was really fun. Chrissy, I don't know why we haven't had you on the podcast before. You're way better than Ian and David.
Definitely.
Hey, that was a good...
These guys bring out the best. It's a good group.
Hey, and now's a good time, Scott, to mention Ian's new podcast. Ian, tell us about your new podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Right. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I recorded the first episode yesterday. It's Podium Runner Magazine. They asked me to do their new podcast about looking into helping people train with practical tips and talking to scientists and sports scientists and experts. So it's Podium Runner Endurance Running or Endurance Podcast. That'll be out probably about the same time as this podcast, so from mid-May, and it'll be every month. So my first person I spoke to is someone these guys are very familiar with, Sean Bearden, who used to be the one who corralled us all towards doing the Coach's Corner podcast on Science of Ultra. So I had a great conversation with him, and that's going to be once a month. So Podium Runner Endurance Podcast.
Awesome. And I'm sure you can find it anywhere podcasts can be downloaded. And you're assuming that we're going to actually release this one, Ian.
I'm sure you will. Although I was listening to some really old ones. Didn't you do one with Billy Yang about like finding him a girlfriend and you never released it or something?
That one's still out there in the Ethernet somewhere. We're trying to bring it back in.
We've had a lot of requests for that one. I don't know. I think it may have been deleted.
I'm just surprised you guys are promoting other podcasts. Guys, you need to be confident and competitive and like crush Podium Runner.
No, well, there's a big difference. See, he's using science and facts in his podcast. Ours is just a bunch of rubbish and a bunch of people just
I can put rubbish on my podcast too.
Well, if you need any tips on rubbish, come to Don and myself.
I've got a list of about 47 other hot tips from this link that I found. So if you want any of the 47, you're welcome to them.
Thank you.
Hey, we will make sure that we also link in the podcast description where you can get a hold of each of the coaches to get some coaching tips. Right now, maybe the perfect time to get a coach because you may have a little bit more time, a little bit more focus to work on specific things and get in shape. So I would think right now is the best time to get a coach.
And we'll link also Chrissy's book that she's written, Running Your First Ultra. That's important too. So we'll do all of those things. Go out and
Happy Runner. Yeah.
Oh, Happy Runner. David, I'm sorry. I've got that book. I've read it. I've loaned it out to somebody and they haven't. Hey, if you have my book out there, bring it back. It's a good one. I liked it so much that I gave it to a friend. So go out and run.
Mass.